The time is now. Volume 1, Episode 17. This is Employment Law Now, and I am Mike Schmidt, Vice Chair of the Labor and Employment Department at Cozen O'Connor. For those who have been listening for some time now, even binge listening, thank you so much for coming back. For those who have just found me here at Employment Law Now, thank you very much for listening, and I do hope I make it worth your while to stay. We're going to start with our Trending Now segment, and I want you to think about what your goal is. What is your goal as a company, as an employer? Is it discipline management when it comes to your employees, or is it more productivity management for your employees? You know, we always talk so much about employees doing bad stuff, whether it's in person at the workplace, whether it's through social media or online or off premises. And then the question becomes, well, as an employer, how do you discipline them? Can you discipline them up to and including termination? Obviously, it's important to understand your rights and obligations as a company when it comes to performance discipline and performance management. But isn't the goal at the end of the day to get the most out of your employees, to have them be the most productive they can be and therefore the most valuable that they can be for your company? You know, successful companies don't just focus on proper termination, but proper recruitment and retention, getting and keeping the best employees that you can and making sure that you have tools in place to keep them feeling involved and to keep them productive. So today, I want to talk a little bit about that kind of environment. When companies strive to maintain that cliche that a happy employee is a productive employee, there is a reason that it's a cliche, and there's a reason you hear it all the time, because it really is true. It's not just about the fact that your employees, for the most part, are at will, and I hear that all the time from clients. Well, Mike, if this employee doesn't have a contract, doesn't have a guaranteed term, and he or she is just an at-will employee, I can really do anything I want. In fact, I could just terminate him or her, and I don't even have to give a reason for the termination, right? Well, technically, I guess that is true. If the individual is an at-will employee, technically, as you know, long as you're not violating some anti-discrimination or anti-retaliation or other kind of law, the individual's at will. So yes, you can terminate the individual, and I guess technically you don't have to articulate a reason to that individual. But the reality is a little bit different than that, right? The reality is that most employees, most individuals who get terminated and hear nothing about why they've been terminated, well, where do they turn? Once they've exhausted asking you, the employer, for what the reason is, they tend to go to the lawyer down the street, the lawyer at their Thanksgiving table, the lawyer in their family, and say, I need you to approach the company and figure out why I was terminated. So it's about making sure that you don't have disgruntled, unhappy employees. And look, not every situation is going to work out. I understand that. But when people ask me what the definition of a plaintiff is, I always tell them that a plaintiff is simply a pissed off employee. And how do you get plaintiffs? How do you get employees to become pissed off employees? You don't communicate with them. You don't articulate reasons why you're doing and taking certain action, reasons why you've terminated them after being with the company for 20 years. Employees become pissed off employees, and those are the ones who become plaintiffs and cost you time and money when it comes to litigation. Now, of course, every organization is different, and every workplace is different, but I think how you and your colleagues manage your workplace to maximize the value that your employees feel, like they have some stake in the company, and how you manage their productivity as employees is ultimately critical to how successful your company is going to be from a workplace standpoint, from a workforce standpoint, I should say. I read an interesting survey on American working conditions that was published by the RAND Corporation, and there were some very notable findings that I think speak to this point. According to the RAND Corporation survey, 2/3 of Americans say they frequently work at high speeds or under tight deadlines. 1 in 4 believes that they have too little time to do their jobs. More than half of those who were surveyed report being exposed to unpleasant and potentially hazardous working conditions, while nearly 1 in 5 are exposed to hostile or threatening social environments at work. You see what's happening now in the news with the Harvey Weinstein situation, where that is really snowballing to the point of, I think we're up to 60 or 70 some odd individuals who are claiming that at one time or another they were subjected to sexual assaults, sexually hostile work environments. And according to the survey, only 38% of workers noted that their job offers good prospects for advancement. So what the takeaway is here is I think that you have to really continue to be cognizant of what your employees are doing and how they're feeling about their work environment. It's not enough to just say, I'm the boss, my way or the highway. If you want your employees to become productive and valuable employees, and you don't want them to become disgruntled and pissed off employees that ultimately become plaintiffs, you need to focus on your workplace. So what can you do? And have you taken the temperature in your particular office? How can you create an environment where employees feel valued? And how can you communicate these strong interests and these strong values down from your C-suite, down from human resources? Well, what do others in your space do? That leads me to my special guest now segment. And this one really is, I think, special. Rick Turner is the Senior Director of Employee Experience and Diversity and Inclusion at Whirlpool Corporation, where he oversees policy development, employee investigations, and litigation, and he spearheads the company's global diversity strategy. Rick has more than 20 years of progressive human resources leadership experience, and his passion for what he does vis-a-vis the employees at Whirlpool is palpable. Whether you're a big or a small company, I think Rick has some very interesting ideas about how to create the right work environment with employees being involved in creating that work environment. So I give you Rick Turner, and hopefully you find some of his thoughts useful as well. Ricky, thank you so much for doing this on the podcast today. It's really great talking with you.
Thank you for inviting me. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Oh, of course. I think our listeners are really going to find this helpful. And just so we can get started with this, and the listeners are not thinking to themselves, well, why is Mike being so informal? You have told me to call you Ricky. Is that right?
Absolutely. Ricky is my given name.
Perfect. So what is your position at Whirlpool right now?
Yeah, right now, I'm Senior Director of Employee Experience and Global Lead for Diversity and Inclusion.
That's great. How long have you been there?
I've been at Whirlpool, it'll be 3 years this November.
Terrific. How long have you been in HR generally?
Wow. Generally, I've been in HR since about 1990. 1991, wow. You're going to make me date myself. No, about 1994, I apologize, 1994 in HR.
Yeah. That's okay. Some days it probably feels long, some days it feels like yesterday.
It does, absolutely.
And so you mentioned when you told me your title, you referred to employee experience. How does employee experience differ from employee relations, if at all?
Yeah, it differs a little bit. I think employee experience is much more comprehensive. Right? Employee relations generally is what happens after the relationship between the employee and the entity is broken down, right? There's an investigation, there's a termination, something has happened to cause a break in the relationship, and then, you know, you'd rush in and you do your traditional employee relations transactions. You triage things, do the investigation, and you perhaps coach the people leader on how to negotiate their way out of the break. Employee experience is much more comprehensive, and what we seek to do is to create the type of employee experience or the type of relationship with the employee that doesn't break down. So We try to get far enough ahead of those breaks. We try to anticipate behavior. We try to predict responses so that we don't have breaks in the relationship.
That's interesting. And where is this sort of philosophy of human resources come from in terms of what the role is going to be, which as you've described, is certainly much broader than many HR roles that we hear about?
Yeah, it's interesting. It helps if you think of employee experience similar to a consumer experience or shopping experience, right? So you know that when you go to Amazon, sometimes it almost feels like they know who you are and they can anticipate who you are and what you're going to want to need. And they get that information really based on the data that you provide them. And so employee experience really seeks to take data that employees provide us with, all the little bits of data about their behavior, about their mood, about their transactions. And what we want to try to do is analyze that data so that we can anticipate how employees are going to behave or respond, right? So it really kind of comes out of a commercial space. The same way a marketer would know that, hey, when you walk into Target, you're going to immediately go right and you're going to walk around the outside wall and then you're going to come up the middle of the store. We can use that same type of analysis to anticipate how employees are going to behave or respond.
That's really interesting. How many employees, and we know Whirlpool is obviously a big corporation, how many employees are under your watch?
I'm a global entity, so we have 93,000 employees worldwide.
Wow. And one of the things that I think is most helpful to our listeners who tend to be HR professionals as well as in-house counsel for the most part is to hear from people like you in this field and gain some great knowledge about your experiences, the things that you struggle with, the things that have been successful for you, so that they can bring it into their own businesses. What are the kinds of things from an employment law and labor standpoint that keep you up at night these days?
Wow. So the things that keep me up, I think, are a little bit more esoteric is the word that's coming into my mind, but I'm not sure that that's the case. Right? It's really the changing relationship between employees and the entity, right? When our parents worked, there was an understood kind of informal social contract between the employer and the employee, and there were really rigid rules around what employees could do, should do, either formal written rules or informal rules, and they were kind of, there was a written set of an understood set of behaviors that the employer would take, right? The most cliched is, hey, you work here for 25 years, you'll get a nice watch and a pension, and then you'll ride off into the sunset in your station wagon and all of that, right? Well, all of that has been disrupted. Right, employees and people have changed, and the way in which we interact with the world has changed. And you know, we're from a generation where we saw our parents laid off, we saw our grandparents laid off, and we saw all of those promises of the 70s and 80s broken through downsizings, right-sizings, whatever they were, right? So we saw our parents kind of go through turmoil. And so my generation enters the workforce, and we kind of look at it and say, I'm not sure I trust you as much as I trusted, you know, as my parents trusted you. And so that change in the relationship causes tensions in employee relationships, right? It's no longer that people are going to come to an organization, and if they're good, they're going to hang out there for 25 years. They may come and explicitly say, hey, I'm only going to be here 2 years, and then I'm leaving. Well, what does that do to you as an organization? What does that do to your talent function? What does that do to the way in which you provide benefits to people when they expressly say, I'm not here for the long term? And along with that, kind of comes in expectation from the employee that you're going to do things that traditionally employers perhaps didn't do, right? Hey, I'm going to expect you to let me leave every Thursday at 1 o'clock because my kid has a soccer game. I remember my dad, and I had baseball practice at 4 o'clock, and my dad would say, I got to work, and that was it, right? Now, not that it's a judgment, right? Both of them are absolutely right. My example is really just to show that the dynamic between the employee and the employer has changed. So it's those types of things. How do I get in front of them? And how do I help my organization navigate through that changing relationship?
And so it's really the whole structure of the employer-employee relationship, from expectations, from loyalty, and really coming from both sides, the employer side and as well as the employee side.
Absolutely. When you talk about keeping me up at night, that does, right? And then you throw in technology, right? The rate at which technology changes. You know, in the 50s and 60s, you could go to a meeting. You didn't have to worry about anybody recording anything that was in the meeting. And not that anyone wants to be malicious, but that technology is out there. And so you're on edge sometimes when you know, traditionally perhaps wouldn't have been on edge. And then the rate at which technology changes your enterprise. So you have an entire group of middle managers that maybe were fostered under one set of technology, and that technology has completely changed in the last 10 or 15 years. And so you have this large section of middle managers that feel like fish out of water, right? They're a little uncomfortable with the changing technology, and perhaps it's placing a strain on their leadership skills, and that strain on leadership skills impacts the relationship with employees, and you get breaks, right? So all of those things create tension in employee relations.
And how have you and Whirlpool actually dealt with the proliferation of employee use of technology and social media that we're obviously all seeing still in 2017?
Yeah, you know, we wrestle with it. Whirlpool is a 100-year-old company, and we're very proud of our history and heritage. But one of the pieces of baggage that comes along with that is we perhaps don't change as quickly as an 8-year-old company, right? So, you know, when you navigate or when you direct Whirlpool, It's like turning a big oil tanker, a super tanker. And when you get a smaller or a younger company, it's like turning a speedboat, right? We turn more slowly, but when we turn, we make a bigger impact on bigger spaces. So with technology, we try to get out in front of it. We have a healthy appetite for experimenting, right? So we create clusters of groups of people that will go out and experiment with new technology, do betas, and then bring them back to the larger entity and perhaps roll them out. In that way, we try to stay in front of it. And from an employee relations standpoint, I really do my best to keep my finger on the pulse of technology so that I can provide the best advice to the decision makers about how this technology is going to impact the organization and perhaps how it's going to impact our employee relationships.
And in terms of having these clusters go out and do some of these betas, can you give me an example of the kinds of things that you'll actually have groups of test people, I suppose, go out and try to do for the company when it comes to technology?
Yeah, and it's funny because when I give you the examples, you're going to say, man, those guys are dinosaurs. But the one that I can remember, right, we recently became an all-Google environment, right, and that's all 93,000 employees, and that's huge when you think about kind of the shift from a Microsoft environment to kind of a Google environment. But that was something that started with the beta of a few employees. Even in giving out, you know, hardware for people, we have betas now where people will use Chromebooks. We have betas where people are kind of testing the functionality of iPads in traditional roles, right? So they're betas that work in those spaces. In the manufacturing spaces, we have betas for barcode readers in manufacturing to keep up with inventory. And really the job of the people in those groups is to kind of experience it, document their experiences, and come and bring us insights to the larger organization to try to decide, hey, is this something that we want to do or not? So those are just a few of the examples.
And you referred to Whirlpool as, I guess, being a dinosaur when it comes to technology. When we're talking about social media and employee use of social media, where has the company been over the last couple of years on the spectrum of, well, one side extreme has you as an ostrich and your head is in the ground, and I don't believe that social media is a big thing, it's not going to last, and let's just ignore the realities, or on the other side of the spectrum and the other extreme, we're really going to say, hey, employees, we want you to be out there on social media talking about Whirlpool and creating buzz for Whirlpool. Where do you guys fall?
Yeah, we are a little bit more to the right. We're more toward the side of we want employees to create a buzz for us. So what we've done is that we've begun to equip employees to be advocates for our business within their social media circles. So for example, right now, if we built a house for Habitat for Humanity, right, our commercial communications team, they may go out and they'll take photographs of it, and we have an internal news outlet or an internal news mag called Whirlpool 360, and they would post the article on Whirlpool 360. Well, in that article is a link that allows employees to post that article on their LinkedIn page or on their Facebook page. They simply need to kind of go in and register their Facebook page with us or their LinkedIn page with us. Now, along with that, as you can imagine, right, there come risks. So we try to do a great job of explaining to people what the rules of the road are, what's allowable and what's not allowable, and perhaps what type of risk you run by kind of engaging in that type of activity with us. By and large, the bulk of our employees are dynamite employees, and they'll post if we've done a Habitat for Humanity build, if we did something with our United Way partners, or if we did something locally. We get employees to get engaged and to get the word out. Every now and then you get curveballs, right? You get people that either don't understand or are not aware, or, you know, just being generous, just, you know, not doing the right thing with social media, and then we have to intervene and course correct at that point. But majority of our employees are dynamite, and they do the right thing as it relates to social media.
And how do you think they view the company with regard to social media and what your policies are? Do they view you as still a dinosaur? Do they view you, you think, as this advanced company that's really out there in 2017 trying to be proactive?
That's a tough question, right? So with 93,000 employees, you know, we got a slice of the entire globe. So we have different groups of employees that probably feel differently about that aspect. We certainly got a group of employees that are technology natives, and they probably look at us and go, we're not moving as fast as we should. And we probably have, you know, Gen Xers or baby boomers that are in our organization that are saying, why in the world would we ever do something like that? So we get an entire cross-section of employees. What we try to do is meet people where they are and give them tools that they're comfortable with. So if you're comfortable in the LinkedIn environment or in a fast technical environment, then we want to meet you, and we want to give you the tools to help advocate for the employment proposition that we have. And if you're uncomfortable with it, we certainly don't force anybody to participate in that space. But we just try to meet employees where they are.
That's interesting. And what about in some of the other areas that people read about when it comes to social media and employers, when it comes to recruitment and the hiring process, or even in the employee relations side when you're talking about being on notice of some offensive conduct and having to start a disciplinary process? What's been your philosophy or practice when it comes to using social media for either of those, the recruitment stage or for the disciplinary part?
Man, social media is a tool, right? Any tool misused will hurt someone, right? So,
absolutely.
From a talent acquisition side, it's a phenomenal tool for us because it speaks directly to incoming employees, right? If we're doing university recruiting, or even if we're doing professional hires, experienced employee recruiting, social media speaks directly to them, and we can give them messages more cheaply, more efficiently than we could if we had to do it, you know, face to face. So it works great. But people do misuse it. And it's a classic case of misuse. You might have an employee that on the weekend does something that, you know, if he did not work for Whirlpool, would think would be absolutely okay, right? Gets into a bar fight or whatever it is, right? And it's happened before, and you go to the Facebook page and you say, man, this guy's wearing a Whirlpool jacket, right? Or he's told everybody he works at Whirlpool on second shift, or he's an accountant at Whirlpool, and here he's done this behavior that's embarrassing to the organization. In those cases, we try to really take a look at them on a case-by-case basis. We weigh what the behavior is. We consider whether it is consistent or inconsistent with our values. And then we try to determine if that behavior has had an impact on the organization's reputation. And a lot of times, unfortunately, you know, if you are wearing that Whirlpool softball T-shirt and you're getting it to the bar fight after the game and you post that on social media, then that's going to be inconsistent with our values. You're not just a regular citizen anymore. You've advertised yourself as an employee of Whirlpool, and then that's when you kind of invite us onto your page. Now, every case is different. I'm speaking in broad generalities, but by and large, when we get pulled onto somebody's Facebook page, it's for something like that. Or someone has said something to another employee. They've made a threat to an employee via social media, and the employee, you know, they work together, the employee says, you know, Dan threatened to kick my butt, right? And Dan works first shift and I work second shift, and you go and it says, yeah, clearly Dan says, when I see you in the parking lot on shift change, I'm going to kick your butt. Well, we don't allow employees to threaten each other, you know, and so that becomes an issue for us to kind of step in and to negotiate.
Do you tend to go affirmatively looking for information either on applicants or on current employees, or do you tend to be more reactive when you hear about something that might be on social
media?
We're
reactive. Usually an employee brings it to us either through our compliance hotline or a complaint to a supervisor or a people leader. We don't affirmatively go look for that type of information.
And we talk about messaging all the time, and you've referred to it in terms of the communication with today's new workforce. It's often very easy to get the appropriate buy-in on appropriate HR issues from the HR department, and very often even, you know, the C-suite of executives at a particular company. How has Whirlpool been successful in getting the appropriate HR message from HR down to the actual managers in the day-to-day trenches, who are the ones dealing with employees?
Yeah. We're getting better at that. We do a good job of it, but we're getting better at it. As you can imagine, with an organization of 93,000 people being 100 years old, we have a lot of institutional change of communication, right? Whirlpool used to operate in a very siloed fashion. So if you worked in manufacturing in Tulsa, Tulsa was an entity unto itself with its own discrete channels of communication. In fact, sometimes its own discrete set of work rules. Here over the last 3, 4, 5 years, we've managed to break those silos, and so we're beginning to grow integrated communication strategies and integrated management strategies. And so now, with the HR business partner there at the facility, they kind of have they have insight into what would happen at the HR leadership team level, and we'd inform them and we'd expect them to communicate with their entity and be the conduit for that information. Also with people leaders, we try to talk directly to people when we've made a decision, so that not that we try to bypass the chain, we just try to have the communication make it so robust that it's almost impossible to miss the message, right? We don't want to discreetly communicate to one person if it's an enterprise-wide change. We try to communicate through a lot of different avenues so that no matter how the employee gets their information, then we've managed some way to pique their interest and to communicate to them.
And so what are some of the ways that your company and I guess HR communicates various policies and expectations to its employees? Do you have these local liaisons? Do you do things electronically through either webinars or intranets? How are you communicating down to your rank and file?
Yeah, if it's a policy change, we use a service center. And so there is kind of a service center website that employees can go to get traditional employment information, and so that policy would be posted there. We also do leverage Google Hangouts or webinars to communicate dynamic changes that people might need to know about right away. Nothing, you know, like a blast email. And then for those employees that don't have access to emails, most of our facilities, if not all of our facilities, have television or communication screens. And so we can either record messages and run them so that people can see them on a shift change or perhaps at break or at lunch if they need to take a look at them, or if they need to stay after work and catch the video, they can do it that way. But, you know, nothing works like an intimate one-on-one conversation or an intimate 3 or 4-on-1 conversation with your people leader. So we try to make sure that we get the information as close to the employee as we possibly can, and then we provide the people leader with talking points, and we encourage them to go out and have a dialogue with people, right? They're not machines. They're human beings. They got mortgages and kids in school like everybody else, and they like to be communicated to like human beings. So we really try to make the communication as intimate as we possibly can.
Yeah, and it's certainly easier to have that in-person, one-on-one kind of communication when you're a company of 10 people as opposed to 93,000 some odd employees worldwide, but that doesn't make it any less important for you to have that interpersonal communication with
absolutely.
Your employees. And so one of the things that are, I think, just as important, particularly when you're talking about a bigger workforce, is getting that feedback from the employees. We talk very often about the cliche, a happy employee is a productive employee, and I think there's a reason why it's a cliche, because it is, you know, very true still, even in 2017. There are things such as engagement surveys and other kinds of communication devices that can be used to get sort of a review back from the employees to their managers and leaders. What are the ways that you try to get feedback from your employees on those kinds of issues and, you know, whether they're happy and ultimately being productive?
You know, it's interesting, man, because employee engagement is a buzzword in HR, and for good reason, right? Again, it's a tool, and if you use it the right way, it's helpful. If you misuse it, then it's harmful. So my own personal view of engagement is that it's just one metric, right? It's akin to someone saying, hey, you know what, Rick, it's 74 degrees today. Well, great. If I'm in the house and I have to get dressed, that provides me some insight, but I don't know if it's raining. I don't know if the wind's blowing from east to west or north to south. I don't know if it's cloudy, right? I just know that it's 74 degrees. There's a lot more information that I could use that would help me prepare for the day. And so we view employee engagement that way. It provides us with a great data point, but it's not comprehensive to provide us with the best data. So one of the ways in which we are embarking upon getting more robust data is that we really want to try to talk to employees more often. Right now, Whirlpool does one employee engagement survey per year. What we're moving to is a model whereby which we create forms so that employees can tell us at any time and all times how they feel about being engaged with the enterprise. So we will begin to experiment with happy or not, right? If you've ever come through the airport and you get through TSA and you got the three buttons there, hey, there's a smile, there's a sad face, right? That's something we can experiment with in our manufacturing facility. We're also beginning to experiment more often with pulse surveys or targeted surveys. Maybe you just came in for an interview and it's been 1 week since you've gotten your job offer. How you feeling? What are you thinking about? All of that data is the data that we use to craft the employee experience. It's the data that we use to figure out how employees feel about being engaged with us. So in that way, it's worlds better than just in a metric of employee engagement. And so that's kind of some of the spaces that we're playing in right now.
And what are the types of things you mentioned, an annual engagement survey that you've been doing? What are the types of issues do you focus on to try to get feedback from employees?
Engagement in its purest sense measures a few things, right? One, are you proud to be part of the organization? Two, would you give discretionary effort in your role? Three, are you going to are you actively engaged, or are you looking to move someplace else? So those are kind of very limited things that you take a look at. Our engagement survey, and you can call it an engagement survey, it's really kind of a cultural survey. It's much more robust. I think there are about 47 questions on it. And we ask things from, hey, how's your relationship with your people leader? How do you feel about our company ethically? Are we doing the things that that we agree to as part of our code of conduct? Hey, what's the flow of information like in your area? Are you getting the messages that we're trying to send? So we actually try to survey in a few different areas so that we can get a much more robust view of, how the employee is situated within the organization.
And how have you found employees have reacted to these kinds of surveys?
You get mixed reactions. Look, if you are a marketer, right, and you're here in the Twin Cities in Benton Harbor, and you have control over your day, which means that you can carve out an hour and thoughtfully work through an engagement survey with 47 questions, then you don't mind. If you work second shift assembly and you got a 15-minute break, and and you have to stand in front of a terminal on your 15-minute break and work through 47 questions, then it might be difficult for you. So we try to give employees multiple ways in which they can engage with the survey. There's a paper survey, which is probably the most mechanical. So if you want to, in fact, take it home and complete it on paper, you can do that. We don't get a lot of those, but some people use them. And then we also allow you to kind of start and stop the survey. So once you register, you can go in, do 4 or 5 questions. You can stop it. You can go back in another time, do another 5 or 6 questions. And you can complete it that way. We try to consider multiple scenarios for employees and give them reasonable options to get that information back into us.
Well, that's really interesting. And certainly another big challenge for so many companies is the fact that employment law, I think, has gone from predominantly being a federal concern to very much a state and local issue on top of it. Being a multi-jurisdictional company, how has Whirlpool and you faced the challenge of staying abreast of the myriad of labor and employment developments in so many different localities?
Man, I think we do a dynamite job. I got 2 great attorneys that work on my team, and we have a network of firms around the country and, in fact, around the globe that help keep us up to date. So at a very fundamental level, right, all of the newsletters or the legislative updates and subscription services that you can be part of, we're part of, and so we keep our eye towards it. And if something pretty dynamic happens, then one of our legal partners in that state would more than likely give us a call or arrange for a video conference and say, hey, in California, this thing changes. This is how it's going to impact you. And then the attorneys that I have on my team are really pretty sharp. So they do a great job of keeping up with not just the legislative changes, but the discussions around potential legislative changes. Right? Again, an organization of our size, it's difficult to change very quickly, so we need to be able to anticipate things that are in the pipeline and consider multiple courses of action, so knowing about something sooner rather than later. And then also our government relations team in D.C. And our government relations partners in each of the states in which we do business do a really good job of keeping their finger on the pulse of local, statewide, and national legislative changes to keep us in the loop of those things.
Yeah, it is so important, as you said, not just to hear about a new law or some new development when it's happened, but to be able to get some advance intel that something is about to come down the pike or something's being discussed and may come down over the next few months. That's just as important, as you said, particularly for companies looking to develop policies mm-hmm. and practices ahead of time. And so one of the last things I want to talk to you about is actually one of the first things you said when you talked about your title there, and you mentioned the concepts of diversity and inclusion. We hear and read so much today about diversity and inclusion, and it's really been at the forefront of the news, I think, lately from a political standpoint, whether it was the political campaigns that we just saw last year, or most recently President Trump's foray into the National Football League, for those keeping track of that. First, how does Whirlpool tend to deal with, if it's had to deal with, this issue of politics in the workplace, where we used to have such a separation? Employees had their home and personal lives, and then they had their very compartmentalized workspace and work conduct, but we see those lines getting blurred. Has this politics in the workplace issue been something that you all have had to deal with, and if so, how have you dealt with it?
Well, you're talking about asking a loaded question, man. Yeah,
I know. That's why I ended with it.
It's difficult for us, right? So again, a 100-year-old company, and I think our past history has been to stay out of the fray, right? We sell and manufacture mm-hmm. products for the world, and you know, you don't want to get into a space that perhaps alienates one segment of your consumer base or disengages another segment of your consumer base based on a particular position that you took. So traditionally, we've kind of said, we'll stay out of those things. But the way in which, especially in this country, the dialogue is moving from an inclusion and diversity standpoint is people are demanding to feel not only included in the workplace, but to feel like they belong. And so people bring their entire self to work, and that includes their thoughts about politics. What it does for the employer, though, is that employees are demanding that employers take a side. It's becoming less and less acceptable to be silent when a particular portion of your population feels like they're being targeted or feels like they're being singled out by something that's happening in politics, right? And so they're demanding that the employer say or affirm, hey, we believe these things about all of our employees. And that's different, right, than it was in the 70s or 80s, right? In the 70s or 80s, you could just kind of be silent. Now employees are saying, hey, I happen to be gay or lesbian, and this person said these things about my community, and you're my employer, and I'm in a relationship with you. How do you feel about those things? And as an employer, you kind of go, whoa, okay. You know, sometimes you're not even equipped to respond. I think what we found is helpful is to, you know, one of our enduring values is the value of diversity and inclusion. And so we simply restate how we feel about our employees. We value each and every employee. And we do our dead level best not only to include employees, but to make sure that people feel like they belong and they can bring their true 100% unedited, authentic self to the workplace. And we do that because one...
And how do you do that? I didn't mean to interrupt you.
I mean, what you really, if you're talking about allowing people to bring their unedited, authentic self to the workplace, one, it starts with just an affirmation of their humanity. Hey, we see you. We know you're a human being. We acknowledge that you bring a particular skill set and also diverse thought, creative ideas to the workplace. Then you have to kind of take a look at your culture, and you got to attack those things that are culture killers, things that either implicitly or explicitly tell someone that they're not part of the whole, part of the group. And then you really try to have to create community. You got to create spaces where people feel like they're comfortable. And there are a lot of different diverse groups that we have in our workplace, right? Perhaps you have a handicap. Perhaps you're gay or lesbian. Perhaps you are Latino or African American. You know, maybe you're a woman. What we need to do, again, or what we are in the process of doing, is creating communities for all those people so that when you come to work, you don't feel like you have to have a work persona and an authentic persona, right? What studies have told us is that people from diverse communities, having to carry those two personas, it exhausts them, right? It's exhausting sometimes being a woman in the workplace, right? And being yourself when you're at home and having to put on a front when you come to work. That's taxing. And what I know is that if you're tired, which is the question we actually ask you on the engagement survey, do you have enough energy to do your job, right? So there's a business need there. If you're tired, then you can't give us your best ideas. Perhaps you're keeping the very best ideas to yourself because you think that, man, if I bring up the idea about this particular color of appliance, you know, the guys are going to say, oh, I just brought that color up because, you know what, I'm disabled or I'm a woman. So I'll keep that idea to myself. When that idea could be the idea that propels us into the next century of growth, right? So we want to eliminate all of those barriers, right? We want to create a space where everybody has some psychological safety and they can be themselves, right? That's how you really create community and that's how you get the best out of your diverse workforce.
And how do you actually roll that out in practice, aside from getting some of the feedback from these surveys, and aside from having, you know, policies in writing, how we're big on diversity and inclusion, we want to promote all of that. How do you roll that out, or how does a company like yours roll that out in practice so people do feel, as you say, that I can come back and be the best me, be the authentic me, and not have to worry about compartmentalized versions of me?
It's a complicated issue, but it's not. It's a simple issue as well. We have stated values about what's important to us in the workplace. And one of the jobs that I have, actually, is to be a truth teller about the organization. And I tell people all the time, I'm a vanguard of our culture. If I see something that's inconsistent with our culture, it's my obligation as an employee to say, hey, that's not consistent with our culture. We don't believe that, right? We don't behave that way. Now, the thing that makes it difficult is that some of your practices are so routine that it becomes kind of inadvertent, right? It's a subtle bias, right? It's, you know, some of the passive language that you use when you talk about candidates or employees. And you have to really put your, as my first grader would say, put your listening ears on. You got to really put your listening ears on. And you have to kind of really watch and be observant to call those things out. The skill is, or you know, one of the, it's not a trick, but kind of one of the helpful things is if you develop the types of relationships with people that will allow you to go to them and discreetly pull them to the side and say, hey, you know, Michael, that thing you said, right, when you, you know, every time that you start these meetings at 5:30, did you know that perhaps there are people that got kids, they got to pick them up after school, and 5:30 is inconvenient for them. They may not say anything, right, but did you know that? I got to develop the types of relationships with people leaders that allow me to have those candid, discreet conversations. And I got to develop other people, because there are 93,000 employees, I got to develop other people in the organization that can do the same thing. That's where a really good HR business partner has a lot of leverage and a big role to play. All of our business partners, I think, have great relationships with the entities that they're assigned to. And so you really count on those people to call those nuances or variances in our culture out. Does that answer your question?
Oh, absolutely, and it really is such a, you know, sounds simple, but it is, as you say, also, you know, a complicated issue. We're in a much different place in 2017 than we were 5, 10, certainly 20 years ago, and it's really nice to hear how a company of your size and of your history is really approaching these kinds of issues. And
man, I tell you what, you know, and the thing is, it's really consistent with who we are. I mean, when you think about Whirlpool, right? I don't know about you, right? But, you know, we own KitchenAid as a brand. We own Maytag as a brand. Like, when I think about Whirlpool products, I think about the refrigerator that my mom would go to get the orange juice out in the summertime. I think about the KitchenAid stand mixer that my grandma used to make cakes. And whenever she went to the cupboard to pull that stand mixer out, I knew some good stuff was about to happen, right? Like, that's who we are. We're in your home. We're part of your family. And so in those ways, we really try to look at our employee base and go, hey, man, this is home. We're about cultivating home. We're about cultivating humanity. And sometimes you just simply have to speak up and say, nah, let's look at the entirety of the person, because that's what they bring to work. They're not automobots. They are human beings, again, with mortgages and kids with braces and daycare issues and all of the things that real people have, they bring them to work.
Well, it sounds like, you know, such a great challenge, having to balance the traditional and the, you know, home comfort feel that goes along with your brand, as well as on the other side having to adapt to 2017 and the realities of today's workplace and workforce. And it sounds like you've all been successful in trying to get in front of
all. This is a journey, it's not a destination. So we're just trying to stay on the right path.
That is very true. Well, Ricky, I can't tell you how much I appreciate you spending some time with us. Hopefully this has been really informative and useful to our listeners who are also trying to strike these appropriate balances in their particular companies. So thank you so much, and perhaps I could tap into some of your knowledge again down the road.
I had a blast this morning. Got a kick out of talking with you. And absolutely, reach out to me at any time. I'd be more than happy to sit down and chat with you.
That's terrific. Well, that was really interesting, and as I said, I don't think it matters how many employees you have, how big your company is. I think the kinds of things that Rick just talked about apply across the board, whether you're a large company like Whirlpool, or whether you're a small mom-and-pop shop with two, three, or four employees, or somewhere along the middle. It's this mindset of focusing on your workplace and making sure that you're doing all you can to both take your temperature of the workplace, but also to make sure that your employees are engaged and make sure they are as productive as they can possibly be. We will continue in future episodes to talk with other in-house folks, both on the legal side and in human resources, to hear what challenges your colleagues are facing and how they're attacking those challenges. Our next episode should be fun as well, as we dive a little bit deeper again into the fall and the winter seasons. And I'll be asking questions such as, what is your company doing about flu shots? Are you having a mandatory flu shot program? Are you having a voluntary flu shot program? What can and can't you do? Also, why does a federal government agency have a problem with love? And what other notable labor and employment cases and developments are happening right now that may impact your company? We've got a lot to talk about, and I look forward to the next episode when I get to share some more of these thoughts and some more trends in the labor and employment field with you. Until then, thanks so much again for listening, and I hope all your labor is productive.